You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 8th to the 14th of May 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and David Matthews and news editor Simon Baker. Making sure graduates use their skills in the workplace could become as important to education policymakers as the quality of university learning in the first place, so claims a new study by Pearson this week. We'll hear more on that in a second. Massive disparities exist in the levels of maternity pay in UK universities. We reveal all in our lead story this week. And I missed last week's podcast. My thanks to John Elms for filling in there. It's because I was out in Miami at Going Global, the British Council event, where I spoke to a Nigerian vice chancellor about an attack by Islamist militants on his campus 2 years ago. More on that soon too. But we'll start with you, David. Pearson has a report out, The Learning Curve, Education and Skills for Life. What's in there?
Yeah, it's got some pretty interesting stats in there. I mean, it sort of looks at the kind of educational performance of different countries. But one of the things we thought was particularly interesting in there is a sort of discussion of, I guess, the skills learned in formal education by students versus the importance of actually maintaining them in work. And there's an amazing graph. Graphs can be that amazing, but you know, it's very interesting. Yeah, we love a good graph, but it's all from skills of adults in South Korea, and South Korea has a very highly developed higher education system. You know, the vast majority of people go into higher education, so the skills for, you know, 20-24-year-olds are very high, but after that they really plummet and actually end up lower than they were than the average for older age groups in comparable countries. One of the things it's saying, one of the explanations for this is that basically South Korean universities are educating graduates for white-collar jobs that simply don't exist. So they leave university with all these skills, but then they simply don't actually use them either in further education or employment, and so they decline. And it quotes Eric Hanushek, who's an educational economist at Stanford University, saying actually in his debate about skills in the economy, basically using skills in jobs could or perhaps should become be as important as formal education to begin with, because we, you know, we always talk about the quality of education university as well. What good is that when 5 years down the line people go into jobs that don't improve them or don't use them? You end up with a sort of much more de-skilled workforce.
Surprises me about Korea actually, because I know a lot of their universities have really strong ties to industry and strong ties to some of the electric giants over there, such as Samsung. So you'd think they might have the sort of finger on the pulse as regards, you know, what we need to teach them and what they're going to be using when they go there, and presumably develop even further once they're in their role.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's true for lots of students, but what is it, you know, 90-odd% of youngsters in South Korea, I can't remember the exact stat, but, you know, a heck of a lot go into university education. Although it's a pretty advanced economy, there just aren't the kind of highly skilled jobs for them to come out with. And on this report I spoke to Sir Michael Barber, who's Pearson's chief educational advisor, and I think what he said about all of this, about skills and graduates needing to keep on learning even after they've left university, you know, his point was your first degree is no longer enough. It could actually be quite encouraging for academics, because he said getting students to leave university with a love of learning is actually great for employability. It's not about teaching them to be, you know, go into one specific job or sort of have a very narrow education. As long as you teach them to keep on learning and enjoy doing that, then that's actually going to serve them well throughout their lives, not just for, you know, personal fulfilment purposes, but actually for their education, for their employment too.
They do say nowadays that people are going to have something like 5 or 6 different careers, three of those careers have yet to be invented. That's for the students leaving schools.
Astronauts
at the moment.
That's really,
well, you know, yeah, you know, who would have thought that the internet would be, you know, where so many people were employed but didn't even really exist when we were there.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I suppose you might develop a love of learning, but it might just be for stuff that is actually, you know, you're really interested in, or it might not necessarily be useful for a new job. I mean, there's, you know, you know, not everyone is going to enjoy learning, you know, new skills about every conceivable job. So But I think generally it's probably quite good reading for academics who want to instil their students with a desire to know more.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people do have several careers, it's certainly something that they need to think about. But our readers are mostly in the same or very similar career, of course. They are academics, they're working at universities, and one of the most important aspects for many employees is the benefits they get. Jack, your splash this week, I know it's been building for a while. It's all about maternity wage inequality in universities.
Okay, well, this is some data that's been collected by the UCU, the largest academic union, and they collected all the different maternity pay packages out there. And there's some massive disparities in the generosity of these, of what the universities are offering. So some at the very top, particularly those mentioned at Manchester, Oxford, Birkbeck, they're offering very, very generous packages for almost all staff. That's 26 weeks at full pay. Others are only offering 4 weeks full pay, then 2 weeks at 90%, and then followed by 12 weeks at 50%. So basically what this boils down to is that someone at one institution could be receiving about £18,000 if they were on about £32,000 as their basic salary. But someone at another institution could be receiving about half that. And it's quite interesting because each university has their own policies, but some are very generous and some really aren't.
Mm, it's surprising there's such differences. Do you think this kind of thing might be fairly standardised across
the
sector?
No, not at all. This is what's showing.
I mean, at the end of the day, institutions are autonomous, aren't they? And they offer, I mean, they would say that, you know, this is just part and parcel of, you know, we set salaries, but we're also going to, the thing is, I suppose salaries are standard, aren't they? Standard according to a pay scale, aren't they? So in a way, it does make it surprising. But yeah, as I said, universities are independent, aren't they? So they can, there is no way of making everyone offer the same, you know, benefits. At the end of the day, they can choose what they want to do. But that's why there's such disparity. But
yeah, there are big disparities, and there's also quite a lot of uncertainty because women who might be going on maternity leave are only in the early stages of their career, generally, sort of in their maybe early 30s. And some of them will be on fixed-term contracts as well, maybe doing a sort of scholarship, maybe funded by a research council. And so there's a sort of uncertainty about who's employing them. Is it the research council? Is it the university? Mm. And so, you know, they might worry about, you know, what it's going to mean for their career if they go off and have a baby or two. Mm. And so we've just been talking to some female academics, and they're saying that there needs to be a lot more clarity from research councils and universities, and also that there needs to be more help for women coming back from maternity leave.
I mean, it seems that the sector's kind of only cottoned on to some of these issues in some of the last few years sometimes, because, I mean, they only just changed the rules, I think, in the REF, so that, you know, if you've had a period of, your woman's had a period of maternity leave, then you don't have to submit so many papers. I think they only just changed that rule,
That's true.
Seems kind of crazy, really, mm-hmm. That they've only just decided that, they're at a disadvantage because of that. So
I mean,
does seem there's quite a long way to go on some of these problems.
It used to be that if you're an academic, you had to sort of take a vow of celibacy. Obviously you're a man, but you were sort of living an almost monastic lifestyle back in the 19th century. But, you know, obviously things have moved on.
Yeah, we don't want the academy to be behaving like it's
a lot of things since then, but some are very progressive and some institutions maybe not so.
Well, find out which are which on page 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. A slightly shorter podcast this week, but don't worry, we do have several other podcasts in the on the horizon, as well as a couple that came out last week. There's a new books podcast up on our site, and also we have the 100 under 50 rankings podcast still available for you there. That was launched last week out in Miami at the Going Global event where I was. That's also brought another podcast our way. I spoke with a Nigerian university vice chancellor while I was out there, and that's going to be covered in an interview podcast, and is also on page 10 this week. He was a very interesting chap, actually. Goes by the name of Aboubakar Rashid. He's vice chancellor at Bayero University in Kano. And he was just a delegate at one of the sessions out there, which was about how universities can help in areas that have suffered from conflict. And we heard some interesting things about Egypt and Syria in that discussion. But he sort of stood up and asked a question and said that he'd had a terrible incident at his university where 18 people, including three of his closest friends, had actually been killed by Islamist militants.
Just to sort of cut in there, Chris, I mean, it sounds like, we obviously talk a lot in these pages about, problems that universities have in terms of policy and funding and that kind of thing. But this kind of brings home that some countries are sort of in dealing in a completely different kind of environment, really. And obviously, Nigeria is in the news a lot with Islamic extremism at the moment. What kind of sort of perspective did he give you on what it's like kind of running a university in that situation?
He spoke very emotionally about it. I mean, he sort of talked of how he watched this sort of extremism creep closer and closer to where his university was based, and people in the campus started to become concerned that it might actually become a little too close for comfort, and so it proved. And on this morning, it was a Sunday morning 2 years ago, they were attacked. 18 people lost their lives, and he said it completely changed the way that he has to run his university. Before, it was a campus, the way he describes it, much like any other. People could come and go, people were studying, it was open, but of course after an incident like that, things completely have to change. And he was telling me that nowadays you can't leave a bag lying around without 10 or 11 students flagging it up straight away. That the atmosphere on campus is just a lot more attentive, security is at the top of everyone's agenda, and he said that was quite a sad thing. But if you listen to the interview and read the article on page 10, he does sort of look for a silver lining. He says that they could have been defeated by this attack. It could have been something that forced them to change the way they did things radically. It might have put, he said, Christian academics off applying to work at the university. Now, that's not happened. They've actually got more than they did before the attack. He says that they're more united than ever. It was a terrible, terrible incident. But if you listen to that interview, you'll hear how they are doing their best to make it into something, at least with some positive aspects for the institution. But I'll leave it there, because it is available online in the same place as you found this podcast. That's all for this week's issue review. If you want to comment on anything you've heard about, or indeed anything you've read in the magazine, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on Google+. Please do let us know your thoughts. But that's all for this week's issue review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.